This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for being with us on our Main Street radio show all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to talk about a subject that should be of interest to a farm state like North Dakota. And of course, there are many of them in the Upper Plains and in the U.S. in general. This issue we're going to talk about is a study that was just released about a week ago, which was sponsored by the National Wildlife Federation, saying that a mandate to increase the production of ethanol that's been proposed by the Trump administration and the Environmental Protection Agency could have bad effects on the environment and, for that matter, on habitat. And so we're going to talk about a person who's interested in this. David DeGennaro is a National Wildlife Federation policy specialist. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. David, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Why did the Federation commission this study?
Well, you know, ever since this mandate to use biofuels, namely corn ethanol, in our gas tanks was put into place more than 10 years ago, we've seen that farmers have responded to that demand by increasing the amount of corn they produce and actually increasing the total amount of farmland all across the country. And that's had grave impacts to wildlife habitat. You know, as you take native prairie and conservation lands and put that into farm production, that means less area that's available for important wildlife species. And then all that additional land, as it's being farmed, is seeing additional fertilizers and additional runoff and erosion, which is also impacting water quality. So we really wanted to understand what exactly this policy and this mandate that the federal government put in place, what the impact to the landscape is. And so that's what this new research has shown us. We finally have a much clearer picture of what those impacts are.
So essentially, this study affirms what you already believed, and you were looking for some detailed analysis.
Yeah, we've seen it on the ground. You know, I think most people in farm country would acknowledge that there's been a transformation starting in 2006, 2007, as there was a ramp up in the farm economy. And so we knew anecdotally what was happening, but there hadn't been a very clear scientific link drawn that would show that the policy itself was responsible for some of this, not all of it, but certainly a significant portion of that expansion.
Who conducted the research?
It was a team of researchers from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, from Kansas State University, and from the University of California at Davis. And what they did was they looked at the price impact stemming from the demand for these new biofuels for corn ethanol. And what that did was it raised the price of corn by about 30%. And then it also raised the price of other crops like wheat and soybeans by about 20%. And so they took that price signal and used models to figure out how farmers would respond in those situations and found that, in fact, they are planting about 2.8 million acres more crops than they would have without that policy in place.
Well, we've certainly seen that effect in North Dakota. There's a lot more corn grown here now than there was 10 years ago. How will this study be used with the results that you came by? How are you going to apply them to alter whatever policy you want to alter?
Well, first and foremost, we want to just educate the public and policymakers that this is a problem and that this policy has contributed to some of the impacts that we've seen. So we are hoping that people will go to our website to learn more about the research. That's ethanol.nwf.org. And then, you know, we're trying to use this to persuade policymakers to change the way that the program is implemented so that there's less of a focus on corn and soy-based fuels and more of an emphasis on more sustainable fuels from things such as switchgrasses or wood waste, used cooking oil, things that don't have this massive environmental footprint. You know, North Dakota, South Dakota, the Prairie Pothole region is critically important for wildlife, particularly for waterfowl. It's the America's duck factory. More than 60% of all of the ducks that live in the United States are born and bred in that region. And we've seen area supporting hundreds of thousands of ducks has been impacted by this policy and making it harder for those populations to continue to thrive. So, and the monarch butterfly, they have shown that Millions and millions, hundreds of millions actually, of milkweed stems have been lost due to agricultural conversion, and that population has seen drastic declines, and they're considering to list it under the Endangered Species Act. So all of these things need to be taken into account when we consider whether we should be mandating these fuels and requiring them.
Well, you know, corn and soybeans have been used to make cooking oil for a long time, so it sort of makes sense that they might be used to make an energy source that could be blended with gasoline. You mentioned switchgrass as a possibility to, you know, convert to what's called, I think, cellulosic ethanol. What's the status of that research, and how efficient is that?
Well, at the moment, it is more expensive to make than it is for corn ethanol. You know, corn ethanol has been around for a very long time, as you say, and so the technology was a little bit more difficult to develop to get fuel from those other types of plants, but they can do it now. The problem is that with corn ethanol being such an entrenched industry and able to be produced relatively more cheaply, it's hard for those other fuels to really get a foothold in the industry. So that's where we see a federal policy having a role in really helping support those other sources of fuel that are more sustainable, don't have the same water footprint, don't need the same land requirements, and can be supportive of wildlife populations while producing fuel.
Well, this is a real bread and butter issue where we are here. And the ag economy in North Dakota and in many places in the U.S. is really under stress, soybeans in particular, as one particular cash crop because of the trade issues with China. So this is a kind of a tough time to bring this topic up, isn't it?
I mean, the National Wildlife Federation definitely supports the farm communities and farm economy. You know, we're big supporters of the recent farm bill that was just passed. It had a lot of really great incentives and support for wildlife and conservation and sustainable farming in it. And, you know, but there are definitely better ways to support the farm economy that don't have these same impacts. You know, as you mentioned, North Dakota was not traditionally a big producer of corn, but now it has seen a lot more of that. You know, there's a lot of farmland that was brought into production that is more marginal and probably isn't being very productive, isn't having the same yields that farmers would like. By supporting other types of fuels, you know, a farmer could take some of that marginal land out of corn production, put it back into grasses that would be a better use of that land and still have revenue stream from those lands. So it doesn't have to be an either or. This could be an alternative way for farmers to diversify their revenue stream.
Well, the world is under a bit of stress in general. We do have climate change that's happening. World populations are increasing. Every human being eats to survive and drinks water to survive. So let's bore into some of the specific findings of this National Wildlife Federation-sponsored study. What species are particularly threatened and why?
Yeah, I mentioned waterfowl in the prairie pothole region. That's certainly a big concern. Grassland birds in general, they are under threat for a lot of reasons, mostly because of reduced habitat, and a lot of that habitat has been lost to agricultural production. More than a third of grassland bird species are under serious threat, are of major conservation concern. And so that's one thing that we're worried about. Again, as I mentioned, the monarch butterfly, their populations have crashed by about 80% over the last 20 years, and they're being considered for listing under the Endangered Species Act. So I would say that those are the primary species that are of concern, but they also found that there are 41 individual species that are already listed as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act that saw significant habitat destruction within their critical habitat. So they have seen impacts directly from this agricultural conversion.
And this agricultural conversion does require, you know, the application of farm machinery, which burns fuel and clears land to create crops on. So irrigation's affected, water supplies are affected. I'm getting the sense that the more land you farm, the more resources you need to farm.
That's absolutely true. They found that a lot more nitrogen fertilizer was being applied to fields, and an increase of actually 5% more than had been used previously because of the policy. They found that water use over the Ogallala Aquifer has gone up, which is already under a lot of stress, and that in some states that require irrigation, more than 1 million gallons of water was being used to irrigate the corn that was producing 1 gallon of ethanol. I mean, that's just crazy. And you mentioned climate change impacts, and that's also been a big factor. When you plow up land that had not been used before for farming, that releases a huge amount of carbon from the soil into the atmosphere, in addition to the burning of fuels and application of fertilizer. And so they found that the policy was responsible for as much carbon emissions as 5.8 million cars on the road every single year, or 7 coal-fired power plants. So that's a huge addition of climate pollution to the air, just at a time when we're sort of at this tipping point where we need to be reducing those emissions.
Well, climate change, as you've indicated, is a worldwide phenomenon and problem and issue. The National Wildlife Federation is a U.S. organization. Do you have international connections? Because if we just do it, it doesn't make that much as much difference as if the whole world gets on board on this kind of idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's going to take global action, not just here, but all around the world. We've been very supportive of efforts to do that. You know, we're very supportive of the Paris Climate Accord that happened a couple of years ago, which the U.S. has since withdrawn from. We think we would definitely need to get back into that so that we can be part of the worldwide solution and not just an individual actor.
Well, as you mentioned, ethanol has been around for a long time now. It's an entrenched industry in certain areas of the country, particularly here, for example. In a sense, is this tilting at windmills right now, though? The fact that there's a study out that says what you expected it to say, and I think people would agree with you as they drive around a farm state like ours. They've seen changes here, but they've seen these changes because the economics mandated these changes.
Right, and that's kind of what we're getting at here. You know, there are lots of drivers of farm economy. You know, China is a huge demand for soybeans, for example. Those things are out of our control, but this is a government policy that specifically drove these changes on the landscape. And so that's one thing that we do have control over and we can change and improve on. And so that's why, again, we'd like to see a shift in emphasis so that we can support more sustainable fuels that don't have the same impact.
There's another direction here, too, and that's sustainable agriculture. That gets discussed quite a bit, too, moving away from monoculture and you know, using soils more intelligently. Is that something that you advocate, the Wildlife Federation advocates?
Absolutely. We were big champions of the conservation provisions of the Farm Bill to help give incentives to farmers, help cost share on some of those things that require money to do, money to help set aside marginal lands, put that back into conservation. Those are all things, you know, we want farmers to be able to succeed and have the tools available to do so in a sustainable way. Here in Washington, the debate around the renewable fuel standard or the ethanol mandate has really been the corn and ethanol industry versus the oil industry, and that's really the narrative that's been at play. We really want to build in the environmental concerns into that conversation so that people are talking about those as well.
Does this put the National Wildlife Federation in an odd coalition with oil producers for this particular issue?
You know, we have some overlap with what their view is. They, you know, would like to see the program go away altogether. That's definitely not our position. You know, we think, as I said, that there's a role for sustainable biofuels, and we'd like to see those brought online and supported. But you know, I think we're willing to work with whoever is the right partner to see that happen.
Well, politics can create strange bedfellows sometimes, so I was just interested in asking that question. David DeGennaro is a National Wildlife Federation policy specialist. He's speaking with us from Washington, D.C. David, thanks for being with us today on Main Street.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, Harvest Public Media reports on the refugee workers in meatpacking.
Next time on The Pulse, modern medicine has blurred the lines between life and death.
They seem to be biologically alive, but they're never going to wake up again.
This can be a really difficult situation for families.
She started moving around, doing things that dead people aren't supposed to be doing.
The space between life and death.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Work at a meatpacking plant is physically demanding and it can be dangerous, but it's where many refugees find employment after relocating to the United States. However, that's changing. Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports that companies are finding it hard to hire enough workers due to the Trump administration's refugee policies.
The JBS plant in Greeley, Colorado is massive, processing thousands of cattle a day. More than 3,000 people work here, and many are refugees, like Abul Basar.
How are you? Oh, thank you.
I met Basar at his apartment, along with his wife and two young children. He tells me he was violently persecuted in his former country of Burma, also known as Myanmar. He fled and spent 5 years running from country to country.
So this time is the very difficult times. I don't have work over there. Just eating, sleeping, that's it.
He was finally resettled in Greeley in 2017, and his case manager got him the job at JBS.
It's a very hard job. It's a very difficult job. JBS, very difficult. It's not easy.
But it's one of the few jobs that requires little to no English and pays a starting salary of about $15 an hour. That's why, according to a study by the Fiscal Policy Institute, meatpacking has the fifth highest concentration of refugee workers behind taxi and truck drivers.
I mean, refugees have been very good employees and are very good employees within the industry.
Eric Mittenthal is with the North American Meat Institute, which represents the meatpacking industry. He says plants are struggling to find enough workers due to low unemployment levels, but also because there's fewer refugees. Under the Trump administration, just 33,000 refugees were resettled here in 2017, the lowest number in two decades.
Well, I think as those general policies impact the overall labor market, then yeah, there's a tie there.
Mittenthal says the worker shortage means plants may have to shut down a processing line and can't meet production goals. Companies like JBS, which advertise hundreds of entry-level positions at its 58 plants around the country, are trying to attract more workers with free English classes, sign-on bonuses, and higher wages.
The economy has picked up. It's very different from what it was 10 years ago. And that means that all of a sudden, employers want to do a lot of hiring.
Chris Tilley, a labor economist at the University of California, Los Angeles, says there's a labor shortage across all industries. And he says President Trump's policy to limit refugee arrivals ignores the need for more workers.
The policy now is less a pragmatic one and more an ideological one. In some ways, making a point rather than serving a purpose in terms of how the country works.
It's also likely having an adverse impact on meatpacking, which Tilley calls jobs of last resort. The Department of Labor says the rate of injury for meatpackers is 2.5 times higher than the national average. Abul Basar says he spent more than a year working on the JBS production line, where he used a large electric knife to disembowel cow carcasses. After a few months, his hands began to hurt.
Show me what it is that happens. It gets stuck like that?
He tries to straighten the fingers on his right hand, but his ring finger stays bent.
It's locked, my fingers. Yeah, it doesn't work.
The interpreter says it happened from making the same repetitive motion day after day. Despite his injury, Basar says working at JBS is the best option for supporting himself and his family.
He has to go to JBS because it is the easier one to get a job for non-English speaker.
The day after I visited Basar at his apartment, we met up with the interpreter at a doctor's office in Greeley. Basar's here to see a hand specialist who will determine if he needs surgery.
I want to check in my finger.
After a 20-minute appointment, Basar returned to the waiting room with good news.
Doctor says it's okay.
Physical therapy and a temporary break from his job on the processing line have helped. Again, Basar's interpreter.
It's much better than before, so no need to have a surgery.
Basar is visibly relieved by the news as we say our goodbyes. It was time for him to get ready for his 3 p.m. shift at the JBS plant. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks at farm and rural issues. Next on Main Street, a commentary from Mark Trahant.
Next time on Threshold.
What are they chanting? Putin what? Thief!
What does this Russian protest have to do with the Russian Arctic?
Corruption is very much in our country, and we must change this.
Next time on Threshold.
Threshold, this week's Prairie Public Presents, comes your way Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Mark Trahant is the editor of Indian Country Today. He also voices commentaries about current affairs from the perspective of Native Americans. Today, Mark's topic is the federal budget proposed by President Donald Trump and the reception it's likely to get.
President Donald J. Trump has outlined his budget for fiscal year 2020. It would slash funding for virtually every domestic program, add money to the military budget, and, of course, build a border wall. The document is titled A Budget for a Better America, Promises Kept, Taxpayers First. The president's budget would save nearly $2.7 trillion, more budget cuts proposed than any administration in history. Only Congress, not the president, decides how much money will be spent in the federal system. At best, the administration writes a budget that initiates a conversation. The real work of the budget occurs in the Senate and House Appropriations Committees. Not that presidential budgets are totally worthless. As the White House said a year ago, the budget is a messaging document. Last year's budget, for example, assumed Congress would repeal the Affordable Care Act and replace it with a block grant. As I wrote a year ago, the votes are not there for that. It's fantasy. And that was when Republicans controlled Congress. The House is now under Democratic Party control, turning the dial even more towards government. So it's not useful to get excited about the numbers in the White House budget, probably any presidential budget for that matter, and instead focus on the larger issues. One big picture issue is that Congress and the president must reach a deal on spending under the Budget Control Act, or there will be more budget cuts of about 11% across existing budget figures. Domestic and defense programs are cut about the same under a sequester, an idea that's supposed to make it easier to reach a deal. This is the economic version of the good, the bad, and the ugly, a three-way gunfight or a truel. The players, those who hate government, especially domestic programs, and those who want more money for the military. Those who would like to significantly cut military budgets but spend more on federal programs. And then the President of the United States. He's the wild card. At least in the movie, the wild card character fought without actually having a loaded gun. Congress knows this chaos is expensive and bad management, so there might be enough votes to fix the process, particularly for programs involving American Indians and Alaska Natives. Congress could appropriate funds for key programs, such as those that provide services in Indian country, for at least a year in advance. This is already happening in many education programs. Given the increasing budget uncertainty, this might be the year to make it so. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can read more about Native issues online at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezern, Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom, and our What's Happening calendar of things to do. First, the news.
Thank you, Doug. U.S. Secretary Alexander Acosta says North Dakota is doing many things right, but it's still facing challenges when it comes to workforce shortage.
Your unemployment rate is 2.5%. Virtually, if someone is looking for a job, there are jobs available. Nationally, we have 7.2 million open jobs. For the first time in our history, we have more open jobs than individuals looking for jobs.
Secretary Acosta was invited to North Dakota by Senator Kevin Cramer to talk about workforce development. Acosta says North Dakota's success also presents challenges.
And with a 2.5% unemployment rate, filling those jobs is a great challenge to have, but it's a real issue. And so how do we engage more of the workforce? You know, folks that are leaving prison, how do we work with them so they have the skills to have jobs? And that's a win-win for everyone.
Acosta says if you're looking for a job, there are jobs available in North Dakota.
Current estimates put the number of job openings in the state at around 30,000. The Minnesota National Guard is gearing up for the flood battle along the Red River and its tributaries. National Guard representatives from around the state were at the Moorhead Armory to brief government leaders and first responders about available equipment and manpower. David Lean is with the Guard's Department of Military Affairs.
So we're meeting with all the local officials to let them understand what the National Guard's capabilities are and how to be able to respond during a flood type of activity like 9, 10, and 11. So we're just doing the pre-planning now so that it's not a surprise in the future.
Lane says the National Guard has equipment across the state ready to provide assistance. He says the Guard is ready to provide services including evacuation assistance, levee patrols, traffic control, aircraft, radios, and generators. And Minnesota would permanently adopt daylight saving time under a bill making its way through the legislature. A bipartisan group of lawmakers wants to recognize daylight saving time as the official standard time for the state, year-round. The change would be effective upon enactment of a federal law which authorizes states to make the change. Federal law currently authorizes states to choose not to recognize daylight saving time. The House Government and Operations Committee approved the bill this week. The measure has been referred to the Ways and Means Committee. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
Greetings, friends. I am Theodore Roosevelt. I have been gone 100 years, but I think it's just bully that I will be able to pop in once a week on this Grand Dakota Datebook series to share some of my thoughts. As you know, I have a special place in my heart for North Dakota, and I'm so pleased to have a chance to talk with you again. In all modesty, I had a great deal to say on many topics, and I earnestly hope you will find some value in my insights and ideas. So join me once a week on Dakota Datebook and sign up for the, what do you call it? Oh, yes, podcast.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and a writer of note. He's also the voice of the popular Plainsfolk essays you hear on this program. Today, Tom's essay is titled Heart of Dakota.
The Missouri River never had a Samuel Clemens, a.k.a. Mark Twain, to pilot its historic steamboats into the literary canon. Steamboating on the Great Plains in general has been shortchanged by regional historians, beginning with the great one, Walter Prescott Webb, in 1931. This was because Webb was from Texas, and steamboats were not significant drivers of white settlement on the southern plains. On the northern plains, steamboats were far more significant, and Missouri River steamboating has a good historian, Bill Lass. But our understanding of the importance of the subject has become dated. I've come to think that for our story, we need a Conrad, not a Clemens. It's a Heart of Darkness kind of story. It has to do with conquest, the dispossession of native peoples from their lands. On the northern plains, the face of conquest has been George Armstrong Custer. Although he died trying, he represents the aggressive impulse of the movement. And we always believed that men on horseback, cavalry, were the key agents of conquest because they rode out onto the plains and struck the natives where they were. With the work of emergent environmental historians in the late 20th century, we come to a different understanding of what happened. The crucial real estate on the Great Plains was riverine, the channels and valleys of the rivers and creeks. This was true for the agricultural peoples of the plains, such as the Mandan, Idatsa, and Arikara, who farmed the river bottoms. It was equally true for the equestrian cultures, for reasons that are obvious when you think about the matter. Shelter was one value of the river valleys for native peoples. They needed it, but more than that, their horses needed it. We think of Plains Indians as hunters, but more importantly, they were pastoralists, taking care of large herds, which on the northern plains needed winter shelter along the rivers. There was forage all around, but it crucial winter survival time, it was snow-covered. Horses were kept alive with browse, green, woody growth from the riverbanks. Their keepers needed the timber of the same territory for fuel. Take possession of the rivers, and the native peoples cannot hold. Much as cavalrymen may have disparaged infantrymen, it was forts, not horsemen, who took the country. And the forts were on the rivers, which were plied by steamboats that not only supplied the armies but also depleted native resources, burning wood and dispersing game. Why did Sitting Bull so ardently, albeit hopelessly, assail Fort Mandan and Fort Buford? He knew. Just as General Alfred Sully, who built Fort Mandan, knew. Modern armies of the 19th century could not operate without steam-powered support, either railroads or steamboats. Sully was criticized in 1863 for refusing to advance into Indian country because, he said, the water was too low for his boats. But he knew. If you wonder why I liken this situation to Joseph Conrad's novel, and you're familiar with that work, then consider this. In 1864, Sully ordered the heads of three Yanktawana men to be severed from their bodies and mounted on pikes in the heart of Dakota Territory. We have a new history of steamboating by Tracy Potter, published by History Press and entitled Steamboats in Dakota Territory, Transforming the Northern Plains. I'll talk about it next week.
That's Tom Ezern. Next, Sue Balcom joins us for Main Street Eats.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we talk about young George Washington.
Washington was already an American celebrity by the time Thomas Jefferson heard of him, and he participated in the French and Indian War, and according to Peter Stark in his new book, Young Washington, George Washington might have touched off the French and Indian War.
Washington, as a young man, is far different than, say, what you and I were taught in school about Mr. Washington.
Thin-skinned, easily offended, constantly threatening to resign, a clothes horse, vain, and fiercely ambitious.
And a bit of a celebrity, wouldn't you say?
Indeed, he wrote a journal about his time in the Ohio country that precipitated him into national fame and a conversation that didn't end until his death in 1799.
Our discussion this week, young George Washington. Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg. We're in our Fargo studio, and Sue Balcom, the star of Main Street Eats every week here on Main Street, is in our Bismarck studio.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I don't know if I'd be a star as much as maybe a cup of flour or something.
No.
Oh,
I'm a raisin. Flour is very important in
I'm a
many.
I'm a tart. How's that?
Why a raisin of all
things? Well, you're German Russian.
Up? Yeah,
right?
There you go. That dried. We're dried up and wrinkly.
How about you're a kookin?
Okay.
You're kind of kooky, so it works.
That's right. And I love kookin. And the reason that we're talking about it now in March is because for some reason it was always traditionally an Easter dish in our family. And my birthday's in March. I'm not going to tell you
Happy
when.
Birthday.
Well, thank you. But one year, I think I was turning 6 or 7 years old, and my mom asked me what I want for my birthday, which was a rare occurrence because we didn't have these super big competitive birthday parties that kids have nowadays. We were lucky if we got an angel food cake. But I told her, I said, you know, I want my own prune kookin. And that's what I got for my birthday. I got to eat a whole prune kookin by myself.
Well, that was an interesting day you had. Because I'm sure it ended.
The more I learn about Sue, the more questions I have.
So, you know, and this is what I tell people. I teach kookin classes. Okay, I teach my Grandma Emma's kookin recipe, which at one time in my life I never wanted to share because it is divine. It is soft and tender sweet dough, and it's filled with like an inch of wonderful creamy, eggy custard, and then there's fruit that's been pressed into the dough underneath that custard, and then it's topped with a crumble of flour and butter and cinnamon, and it's just straight out of the oven. They're just nothing like a good hot piece of Coogan.
Well, you have my email address soon.
I do, and I can freeze it too. And you know, it would probably stay frozen until it got over there with the way winter's been going.
Seriously.
So,
now I did not know there were variations on Coogan.
Yes, so the one I just described to you is the Coogan that was handed down from my mom's side of the family. But if I'm talking to somebody and we're talking about Coogan and they tell me that they like the flat, unraised kind, I know right away that we're not related because that would make them Catholic. The Catholics must have been impatient Coogan bakers because they do not allow their dough to rise like the Protestants do. And you will always, always, always find Coogan, the flat stuff, at a Catholic wedding. At least back in the day. I think nowadays people love Coogan so much that they'll order it for everybody's wedding. Well, at least where I come from, they order it for the wedding. But I always tell the people that I'm teaching this recipe to is that in the spring, your cow's freshened up, your chicken started laying, you probably had leftover prunes from your long winter out on the prairie with no grocery stores to go to. So Coogan was traditionally made in the spring when they had all of these wonderful ingredients, the cream, the eggs, the milk, everything. Well, hopefully they had flour left over or could get to the store, you know. But everybody that I interviewed when I researched the German from Russia food culture talked about Coogan. And One of my favorite interviews was with Rose Voller Gloss. She was from the Linton area. And I just have to tell you, she said, Coogan? Oh, yeah, that usually went with bread dough. I always made mine with bread dough. If I had some fruit that the kids were tired of eating, or apples, I slice them, and then you put a little bit of cream and egg on top and put the sugar on top of that. A little brown sugar.
Sounds like bread pudding almost.
And that's when they get really good.
Uh-huh.
Well, kind of, but it's the items are kind of kept separate.
Uh-huh.
But here's her last comment. She says, you can't bake it all the time because you're going to get fat. And she was like the skinniest woman I interviewed. So, but they had at Easter time, just about everybody I talked to had Coogan for a special treat. And Cecilia Van Beek, who I think is from Strasbourg area, she actually said that in their house, they didn't consider Coogan to be a dessert. It was more like part of your main meal. So when they'd sit down, they were each given a piece of Coogan on their plate.
I like the way they think.
I do, too.
I'm definitely in line with this.
And one of the best, I think, the best kinds of Coogans there is the cottage cheese Coogan. So if you get milk and you can make your own cottage cheese, you sweeten that with some sugar, like brown sugar and cinnamon, and spread that on top of your dough, and then you cover it with custard, and then you put some more sugar and stuff on the top of it. And that is like a wonderful, kind of like a cheese Danish German style.
I gained 5 pounds listening to you.
Now, with the flatter Coogan, the Catholic Coogan that they serve at weddings, of course, they use sometimes graham crackers in those crumbs, and they don't let their dough rise, so it's a little bit flatter, more like a crispier, pie crusty sort of thing. And a lot of them don't have that wonderful custard on, which is really the best part.
Well, yeah, isn't it kind of the custard that makes it a Coogan?
Yeah, in my mind it is.
Well, when I go to the supermarket now, I see Coogan in the freezer case because there's somebody in North Dakota who's figured out, you know, Fargo likes Coogan.
Well, and that's a wonderful thing because I think that's probably the Coogan that comes from Ashley, and that's made by a Meidinger family, which could or couldn't be one of my relatives since my mother's maiden name was Meidinger. I'm rest assured by blood or by marriage that recipe has been in our family for a long, long time.
Are you getting royalty checks?
No, doggone it. But I did decide that I had to share my Coogan recipe because Two reasons. One is I've had German women tell me that that's the best Kuchen they've ever eaten. And a compliment from a German about food is like the highest honor. Yeah, I maybe am a star because I got compliments from other Germans. That's pretty high and mighty there.
So this recipe will also be on your blog?
Yes, and I'm sharing it because I don't think my grandmother, Emma, would appreciate me hogging it. So that's for right. her,
Good
I'm
job,
sharing
Emma.
That recipe. So.
And that's at therootsellers.com.
Correct.
All right. We check in with Sue Balcom once a week. Thanks, Sue.
Thank you, guys.
What's happening is next.
A tiny desk.
That's it?
Well, and some musical talent.
And a camera. And a YouTube account.
Announcing the 2019 Tiny Desk Contest.
Are we having a good time so far?
Film yourself solo or your band in front of the tiny desk of your choice and perform an original song.
We are taking the Vegas from New Orleans.
Then upload your video onto YouTube between now and midnight, April 14th.
Have something cool and interesting to share because no big deal or anything, you'll be judged by a panel that includes Jason Isbell, Ledisi, and Lucy Dacus.
Oh my God, I dated with big hair and a tiny desk. I want a tiny desk.
Winners will be flown to D.C. to perform in front of NPR's iconic Tiny Desk. And get to go on tour with NPR Music.
Growing musicians, this could be your big break.
Just think of the Tiny Desk alums.
Tank and the Bangas, Galen Lee, Naya Izumi, Fantastic Negrito.
Hey, didn't you win a couple of Grammys?
Yes.
I want to thank Bob Boylan and the NPR Tiny Desk community because I wouldn't be here without them.
And I love you.
So practice, 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 and get your original song in by April 14th.
No stairway. Denied.
Complete contest rules at tinydeskcontest.npr.org.
Good luck!
That's the question every Thursday, what's going on? And Ashley Thornburg is back from her sojourn and joins me to tell us what's on her calendar.
Here is an event that's happening tonight in Fargo. This is the world premiere of The Note Between the Notes, a new song cycle. And this features several people that we have had on Main Street, starting with a poet, Jamie Parsley. He's actually a poet and a priest. And there is going to be music here by Kyle Vanderberg that is performed by Michelle Jelensky. She is a very talented musician who also has been on Main Street. She is a mezzo-soprano singer. There's going to be a pianist there as well. This is a combination of word and song and talented people coming up tonight at the Plains Art Museum, 7 p.m., and it's free.
The basketball is underway Friday in Bismarck at the Missouri Valley YMCA. The Family YMCA presents the annual basketball fundraising event, A Formal Affair with an Athletic Flair. This social and sporty experience will feature a team-themed dinner, sports competitions, mascots, awards, and a silent auction. The event will include prizes like an Arizona vacation, signed sports memorabilia, LASIK eye surgery, and much more. The party will wrap up with a dance to live music from One and Done. All proceeds support your Y for All programs in Bismarck. The hours are from 5:30 to 10:30 on Friday evening. The cost is $50. It's at the Missouri Valley YMCA.
Well, I will pick a similar item here. 2019's Martini Masquerade is this Friday, the 22nd of March in Minot at the Sleep Inn and Suites. This is Minot's big fundraiser here with your chance to have a formal wear and a masquerade ball. So, yes, do come with your own mask, and you will be supporting a local charity here. It's specifically the Companions for Children. This is a youth mentoring program. As you participate in the Martini Masquerade, 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. Friday. The tickets are $80, and remember that it is a fundraiser for youth.
Così fan tutti for opera fans, Friday and Sunday in Moorhead at MSU Moorhead's Weld Hall. Inspired by Downton Abbey, this version of the Fargo-Moorhead Opera's production of Così fan tutti will be very proper. This year's Gate City Bank Young Artists will be Rachel Marino, Kara Morgan, Miles Hare, and Lloyd Richard will play Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's opera for laughs in the Battle of the Sexes. 7:30 Friday evening, 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, with a pre-opera talk 30 minutes before showtime. The tickets will range from $5 to $30. That's Così fan tutti, the opera, at MSU Moorhead's Weld Hall, Friday and Sunday.
Yoga on tap this Saturday, the 23rd, in Williston at the Raymond Center. Two great things to help you relax: yoga and beer. Well, you can combine those. And wow, they are going all out on this. You can actually do this under black light. So wear bright clothing and black lights and have this yoga beer, I don't know, experience, extravaganza. I'm not sure what the right word for this is. And featuring some wonderful Stoneholm craft beer that is going to be, again, in Williston at the Raymond Center, 7:30 to 9 on Saturday, the 23rd. And tickets are $15. And they do ask you to bring your own yoga mat. And with some beer, you might want to throw in a yoga towel.
Yeah. How about the Inspire Lab? It's Saturday at Hunter at the Northern Cass School. The Innovation Inspire Lab is coming to the North Dakota Destination Imagination State Tournament. With a variety of STEM arts activities, kids and adults of all ages will be engaged in fun, educational experiences to expand the imagination. Included in the lab will be a Ductapia Creation Station and a Kiva Plank Build Zone. It's from 11 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon on Saturday. It's free. Again, it's in Hunter at the Northern Cass School.
Napoleon Dynamite, I don't know how many of you laughed your butts off at this film when it came out some 15 years ago, but two of the stars of this film will be at the Fargo Theater during the Fargo Film Festival, and this is tonight, 6 to 8, as you get to talk to Napoleon Dynamite and Pedro themselves, order up some quesadillas and what have you, enjoy that very funny film, and have a freewheeling conversation with those two performers here, 6 to 10 p.m. tonight at the Fargo Theater. Tickets are $35 for the screening of the film and the conversation that follows.
St. Louis Brass playing in Grand Forks Sunday at the North Dakota Museum for Art. The St. Louis Brass Quintet performs the entire spectrum of great music for brass, from the works of today's composers to Baroque and Renaissance music transcribed for modern instruments. Lighthearted entertainment intertwines with serious classical music. It starts at 2 in the afternoon on Sunday. The cost is $20. It's the St. Louis Brass in Grand Forks at the North Dakota Museum for Art on the UND campus. What's your pick?
All right, my pick of the week, now that we're into spring finally, although sometimes you'd never know, a polar plunge this Saturday in Dickinson at the Cashwise parking lot. This is a fundraiser for the athletes of the Special Olympics of the North, and so you are going to be freezing for a reason as you jump into the water here. Registration begins at 11 a.m. It's free to watch or $75 to participate and raise money for these talented athletes this Saturday in Dickinson.
Well, my pick is a little self-serving. It's Tuesdays with Maury. I get to be in it. It runs tonight through Sunday in Fargo at the Stage at Island Park. The Fargo Moorhead Community Theater presents the stage play based on the best-selling book, Tuesdays with Maury. It's the story of author Mitch Albom's weekly discussions with a favorite professor, Maury Schwartz, who's dying of ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. David Wheeler directed the show, which features Nicholas Kaspari as Mitch, and he plays the piano for real. I get to be on stage with him. It's a lot of fun. 7:30 curtain through Saturday, at 2 o'clock matinee on Sunday. Adults, $23. Seniors, I qualify, $18. And students, $13. And that's what's happening.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Shen Yun presents 5,000 Years of Civilization, combining ancient legends with technological innovations, historically authentic costumes, and storytelling. Through classical Chinese dance, Shen Yun shares diverse ethnic and folk traditions filled with orchestral sound. May 5th at the Chester Fritz Auditorium in Grand Forks. One performance only. Tickets at shenyun.com. S-H-E-N-Y-U-N.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 21st. North Dakota has its own version of the Grapes of Wrath. Similar to John Steinbeck's Great Depression story is The Bones of Plenty by Lois Phillips Hudson.
She writes about the fictional George and Rachel Custer and their family's wheat farm near Jamestown during the Dust Bowl and Great Depression. The story unfolds over 15 months, throughout drought, fire, disease, death, and taxes. George Custer is a hot-headed farmer who reads the Jamestown Sun backwards and forwards and criticizes the federal government, the local sheriff, his landlord, neighbors, and members of his own family for their opinions and shortcomings. His wife, Rachel, is a former schoolteacher who thinks of the past and worries about her runaway alcoholic brother. The Custers have two children, Lucy and Kathy, and live near Rachel's parents, who are moderately successful after prosperous early years in farming the land near fictional Eureka, North Dakota. Around this date in 1933 of the story, George Custer visits his landlord in Jamestown to negotiate his lease. He wanted to put in more hay, but his landlord told him to plant 160 acres of wheat, to which Custer begrudgingly agreed before he left. Author Lois Phillips Hudson described the moment like this. He was very hot. His hands were slippery on the varnished arms of his chair. His hands were hungry, pleading to wrap themselves around a neck. Hudson's story also describes the bone-chilling cold of winter, the black dust storms of the drought, and the misery of Depression-era farm life, from nearly losing a horse in a poorly buried water well to a hay fire destroying a barn. And then there are anecdotes ripped from the headlines, such as the politics of Governor Bill Langer. She even references the 20-story white tower of the new state capitol building. It isn't a happy story, and it's one the author knew well, as Lois Phillips Hudson grew up on a farm near Cleveland, North Dakota. The farm ran to ruin in the Depression before her family became migrant workers, moving west to the state of Washington. In 1965, Hudson joined band leader Lawrence Welk in receiving an honorary degree from North Dakota State University. She died at the age of 83 in 2010. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Democratic Representative Abigail Spanberger won election from a conservative district. She grows impatient when her fellow Democrats press her to be more progressive.
And I would find it more helpful if other Democrats would talk about their districts and the priorities of their districts so that I don't have to go back to my constituents and say, yes, I know that's not you all.
The pressure to stay true to party and to voters at home. On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, we'll hear from Darlie Newman, the host of Travels with Darlie on PBS and Amazon Prime. Last June, an episode was recorded in North Dakota, and it will air this Sunday on Prairie Public's television service. We'll have our weekly news chat with news director Dave Thompson, and Matt Olean will review another new film, Capernaum. Join us for Main Street on Friday, and in the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.